Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, we're smack dab in the middle of earnings season, so we'll cover earnings galore, but also some other stories, including one involving Samsung. We'll take a look at the auto parts retail market, and we'll lead off with Walmart. First, a quick reminder to like us and rate us however you do find us. Also, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, where Leighton posts pictures of multiple retailers, sometimes Walmart's, and Walmart populates the beginning of the podcast here this week with much-anticipated quarterly earnings on Tuesday. The news was mostly positive for the U.S.'s largest retailer. Now, we saw some headlines on Monday that suggested that Amazon would potentially destroy, and I quote that, Walmart, and that Walmart might struggle in the face of competition, but the reality was positive for Walmart as shares skipped up in after-hours trading, and another 3-4% on Tuesday morning, from $98 on Friday to $103 per share. And Leighton, this latest earnings report was perhaps the most important one for all of retail, as Walmart's online investment and holiday sales push looked to push back against some overarching negative sentiment like the type I just talked about.
This is more or less going to be a podcast of positivity, and as such, we're going to talk about the positive report that Walmart put up. And this latest earnings report was perhaps one of the most important ones for all of retail, as Trent had mentioned, sort of a bellwether stock for the retail industry. Retail spend in the U.S. did miss the mark here recently. Over the last couple of months, it's been down a little bit according to government data. Many are pointing to the hundreds of thousands of government workers and contractors maybe spending a little bit less as they weren't getting their paychecks. And the Commerce Department recently noted weakness towards the end of December in particular. And this coincided with some statements that we've seen from other retailers we've covered here on the podcast in the past, where they note really strong sales in November, really strong sales at the beginning of December, but ended up tapering a little bit towards the latter half of December. And so we look at that trend, we look at several reasons as to why that was probably going to occur. And the reasons for Walmart really not having strong investor sentiment coming into this report had a lot to do with that. And if you took a quick look at Monday's fourth quarter report, however, you would see not a lot of signs pointing to a general retail slowdown for the company, or because they are, again, a bellwether company here in the U.S. for retail sales, really not a lot of reason to think that something bad has happened that is going to affect other entrants such as Target or Dollar General or any general merchandise retailer. And in fact, the company reiterated guidance. Walmart reiterated strong guidance for fiscal 2020. And a lot of this was in regards to revenue. They see revenue being strong in the calendar year to come, and they see also same-store sales being strong. So brick-and-mortar traffic looking to be as robust as ever. CEO Doug McMillon said in regards to this latest quarter that a favorable economic environment was felt throughout the company, and it really helped Walmart grow sales and take market share, he said, from rivals. And he pointed out two categories that we've been driving home here, food and toys. And this is something they've invested heavily in, especially with food. And we'll get into those investments here in a little bit. And to see how they've really come to actually building out some of that infrastructure as far as grocery pickup in a lot of their locations throughout the United States. But as for those larger specific financial results, Walmart brought in adjusted earnings per share of around $1.41 versus the expected $1.33 from analysts. And Walmart also reported net income. Again, this was a GAAP measure that represented the quarter ended January 31st of $3.69 billion, or around $1.27 per share, compared with around $2.18 billion last year, or 73 cents per share. This increase was largely due to not having a lot of those one-time charges relating to program acquisitions. As you may remember, and as we'll point out throughout this earnings release, a lot of those companies they've been buying up, those e-commerce companies, have been digging into the bottom line, but they're wanting to build out a sustainable future. But as such, a lot of those one-time charges, or they'll spread out some charges, like in Flipkart's case, are going to hurt the quarterly results from time to time and make it look a little bit weird when you're comparing year-over-year results. So revenue for the company hit $138.79 billion versus just a little bit less expected. Analysts expected $138.65 billion. Revenue was up 2% year-over-year, so analysts were expecting an increase, but so were those Walmart executives. Same-store sales in the U.S. were up 4.2% versus the 3.2% expected. And to be honest, Trent, you and I were both looking at around 3 to 4%. So 4.2 is indeed a beat, at least in our humble eyes. U.S. traffic was up nearly 1%. So we're looking at those same-store sales metrics. It's always good to see them doubling up on both traffic and average ticket. Average ticket was up also 3.3%. Sam's Club, if you draw them out by themselves, which we usually do on this podcast because we are club fans, both with Sam's Club and Costco, Sam's Club comps, they rose a very healthy 5.3%. This excluded fuel and tobacco sales. Tobacco being of note because this isn't always something mentioned here, but those tobacco sales are decreasing a little bit more due to some regulatory pressures. Those prices, the price of a pack of cigarettes is at an all-time high. A bunch of taxes go into those products, and as such, people tend to smoke less over time, but you really have to draw out those sales because of those particulars. So, of course, many of their customers are for convenience stores. Tobacco products are sold in large part to convenience stores, not individuals. But regardless, you see that retail sales at Sam's Club are up, and you usually have to factor in general merchandise, which would include hard lines, soft lines, and groceries. Groceries being an area that they really want to focus on, especially for those orders that they have been fulfilling digitally, or what they used to call click and pull, where employees would often get in orders that were either faxed in or ordered online for individuals, and they would help sort through the merchandise, collect it so that the customer could come in and leave the store within a quick amount of time, getting usually groceries. And the company during the fourth quarter, we're talking Walmart again, Walmart corporate. Walmart for the fourth quarter retained a 2.65 net margin. Not horrible when considering all of that pricing investment by which, you know, a lot of big banks has been supporting. A lot of big banks that are rating the stock or rating the credit of Walmart are saying, you know what, we will take that short-term margin hit because of all that pricing investment, in particular with groceries. So those commodity items really helping them increase that top line. And as a result, the bottom line, not really a focus as such. Thanks to scale and efficiency, leadership did cite reduced unit costs with shipping via online fulfillment. This is something that, again, they've been trying to build out, trying to invest in. This is what any company that wants to have a sustainable future needs to do, this in the face of greater product assortment. So this is actually pretty tough to deal with. If you think about it, they have a lot more, multiple times more products online via third party and via Walmart.com only items in their distribution network than they did several years ago. So anytime you have a greater assortment of products, yet you have more orders to fulfill, that makes it exponentially harder to try to adjust with. And they've been doing a fairly good job to this point.
Now, for the year to come, and this is kind of actually a theme for this podcast, is retailers kind of taking a look ahead at 2019. Walmart still sees a strong consumer because of relatively low fuel prices, even though those have started to tick up a little bit more recently, and overall positive momentum in the marketplace. So despite these headwinds with other items, like, for example, like what Leighton mentioned with the government shutdown, Walmart still sees overall marketplace momentum. They feel like sales are slated to rise both domestically and internationally, with international forecasts accelerating a bit more despite that Brazilian divestment. U.S. sales, they feel like, will be aided by the continued acquisitions of online retailers. Brick-and-mortar sales alone expected to rise 2.5% to 3% in the U.S., once again beating inflation. And one area of guidance that we feel like they could beat is the 35% increase they've predicted in e-commerce sales. And while they are up against some record trends for online transactions, they are investing more in nearly every channel. plausible that they hit 40% or more yet again, we feel like, for fiscal 2020. Now, one reason for the arguably soft e-commerce guidance, and we say soft e-commerce guidance in the perspective of Walmart, a lot of companies would kill to have 35% increases in e-commerce sales, is that Walmart yet again is going to be refurbishing some of their stores. Now, this has proved to be kind of a never-ending theme for the company, as omnichannel integration and newer branding has been a focal point, and it's been a focal point consistently for the past 5 years. It seems as though, in particular, the last 2 years, they've found kind of a rhythm in doing it correctly and doing it in a way that benefits their customer. In particular, the grocery pickup infrastructure has not been cheap, and they've yet to hit the total market penetration that they desire, but they do feel like their current refurbishing to that grocery pickup infrastructure has been working in those stores that they've been able to do that in. Distribution will continue also to get heavy CapEx exposure. For the record, grocery pickup, which is now available in more than 2,100 stores, and delivery, which is now available at more than 800 stores, they expect that number to, of course, increase, but increase pretty dramatically by the end of fiscal 2020, as they expect to include grocery pickup in 3,100 locations and delivery in 1,600 stores, so nearly doubling the amount of stores that have delivery available. They want to continue to have a broad assortment, including fresh and perishable foods within 10 miles of 90% of the U.S. population. We've talked about this goal before on the podcast, talked about how it may require them to build out more stores in certain rural areas, but also build out those delivery and fulfillment mechanisms in some of those areas. And once again, you know, we talk about Amazon in terms of competition. We've talked on the show before about how if you live in a rural area or if you live in a smaller market, sometimes Amazon just cannot deliver, both figuratively and physically, deliver to those locations on time. And that's something that Walmart wants to use their store base to do, is help to build out their distribution platform. Now, currently, they tout the ability for 69% of the U.S. population to access grocery pickup. Now, the words new and convenience were uttered multiple times in prepared management remarks during the call, even though their most common customer may be a little bit different from that of Target's. They still want their stores to feel fresh and clean and new. They want that new feel around Walmart. They're in the midst of changing their brand from what it was 5-10 years ago. And this is something they underlined over and over and over again on the earnings call. We've noticed this in our firsthand experiences in various different stores throughout the Midwest, for example, getting a revised treatment with LED lighting and new floors. And I know Layton's kind of noticed this here and again on the West Coast as well. Many of their store revisions also come as the company wants to use less energy and wants more of it to come from renewable resources. So you're starting to see those LED buildouts. There's a neighborhood market near me that just installed all LED lighting within the store, but also in the produce section. And we've talked about this before. It's so crucial in produce and refrigerated goods sections to keep those cooling costs down, because the old lights would generate so much heat, the LED lights, not so much. So you're going to see more of that, even more so in 2019 than you were seeing in 2018. They want to continue to refresh the stores, and it's not really a rebranding necessarily, but it's more of a transformation of their brand into something completely different than what we understood Walmart to mean 5 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you look through some of the statements by executives there in the press release and prepared remarks and throughout the investor or analyst questions on the call, you would see that they do actually want to increase or double their renewable energy usage by the 2025, and that's for the United States. But also, they want different energy initiatives globally. So anywhere they have a presence, think of areas in Europe, think of areas in India. They want to be able to do good not only for the communities in which they serve and the shareholders that they have to deal with as far as returning growth and helping the bottom line with those energy initiatives. They really want to be able to make sure that Walmart is sustainable, where they have a footprint, they're able to provide adequate returns while trying to reduce costs and have efficient, responsible growth from within. And I think that's sort of a different Walmart than you would hear of 10 or 15 years ago. Tons of initiatives. And while there have been a lot of criticisms as to how they're going about some of these initiatives, really taking their time in some cases, despite the blueprint that they've sort of laid out over the last 6-7 years. I think Walmart's done a really good job of making a clear picture of all of the bigger missions. And I think that's important for the employees to note too. We talk about management being so integral in these companies, but if you really take, again, a larger view of the company and see how they're trying to communicate these things to the people actually in action at the stores, I think it's a healthy message to say that, look, we want the company to be green. We want to be able to serve our online customers. We want to be there in terms of customer service. And guess what? We're also raising wages for this year and beyond. And I think that's a very healthy message to send to their teams. Is it enough to compete with the likes of Amazon and Target, who arguably have a better demographic to deal with on a day-to-day basis, people who have better income, more disposable income? I don't know. We will see in the future, but as of right now, it's impressive that they still have a pretty healthy net margin, all in all, and they're still able to keep up all of that reinvestment that Trent noted, something that's going to be essential for the years to come. Well, with that, we switch gears and we go into our second story, which is going to be all about the consensus number 3 auto parts retailer in the United States. Advance Auto Parts revealed their latest earnings on Tuesday morning as they continue to work their way back into the auto parts retail market share picture. And we also got an update on the refreshed My Advance web presence designed to bolster digital sales. When My Advance actually was rolled out in December, the idea was to make the platform more attractive to professional customers, something that O'Reilly and AutoZone have been focused on, a major revenue driver for all of the big three in the auto parts space. The big three, of course, being the ones I just mentioned and Advance, and all have been courting professional customers aggressively over the last 2 years. The main draw to the platform, at least according to Senior Vice President Walter Scott, is the capability of professional customers to interact not only with Advance, but with one another to provide all of the feedback that's important on certain parts and accessories in a manner that goes beyond product reviews. If you think about a conventional auto part, it may not be that complicated. It could be pretty easy to install, but guess what? The majority of their platform, the majority of the inventory within that platform, rather, is fairly complicated to install. There may be just little caveats, little tricks of the trade that's extremely important to communicate and to have those customers communicate. It's not a platform like Facebook where they all can be friends and talk about repairing cars to one another, but these little issues that they may have with a certain make or model of a car as it pertains to a certain part that Advance Auto Parts sells is pretty important if you think about it. And it's sort of a feature that we've often wondered, why hasn't this existed previously, other than those blanket reviews, 4 out of 5 stars, product works. So I think that's very good that they're thinking outside of the box. And I think that's what you have to do, again, when you're in this space where it's sort of an oligopoly, but the big two are really taking the market share over everybody else. I think that's very important to be innovative in that regard. And now that being said, we should delve into their earnings. After all, that is why we are covering them this week. It's their fiscal fourth quarter, and we get the full year results as well as a result of it being their fourth quarter. And generally speaking, Trent, the results were positive across the board. We should remember that Advance has been struggling the most with the big three, or the most out of the big three, rather, and leadership was saying as recently as 2017 that they knew execution was lacking and that they had to be better as an overall organization. And we couldn't agree more. And we saw a lot of store divestment, those underperforming stores now leaving. We see a lot of lease negotiation happening with Advance Auto Parts. They're really looking at where they do business and how they do business. And they were better in the fourth quarter, boasting a comp store basis increase of 3.4% and a net sales increase overall of 3.3%. And Trent, the comp increase was in line with what we saw in the company's third quarter as Advance continues to improve over last year's results and outpace inflation in this all-important category.
And we'll talk about these numbers relative to the other auto parts retailers here in a moment, but the improvement over the last two quarters that we speak of helped along full year comps to a 2.3% increase overall. Certainly positive after a bit of a rough fiscal 2017. Positives also came in on the cash flow front, with the company boasting of an increase in operating cash flow of 35% year over year and free cash flow of 50.2% year over year. Certainly not the traditional indicator of a retailer, as Layton said, paring down their store base. Now, these positives do come at the expense of operating income and margin, which was the main negative on the call. If you adjust for these things, these turn out kind of positive. But again, one thing Layton and I don't like to do a lot of is kick out too many of those one-time expenses, because honestly, that is a cost of doing business in some segments. Operating income fell 28 basis points for them, although again, their adjusted operating income margin, accounting for certain one-time expenses, did actually increase slightly. The same could be said of the operating income, which decreased on an unadjusted basis, but did increase 11.7% on an adjusted basis. For the full fiscal year, unadjusted operating income was up 6% even to $604.3 million. So unadjusted operating income up for the full year, another positive sign, again, after a rough 2017 that saw a little bit of scaling back both in the store and in same-store sales. Finally, diluted earnings per share, 74 cents on an unadjusted basis. So if you look at it on an unadjusted basis versus last year's unadjusted numbers, it's down 70.3%. But again, if you adjust for those costs, $1.17 on an adjusted basis. And this is the number that analysts seem okay with. That was up 51.9% over last year. Now, sales were up, but why was there such great margin fluctuation? Well, the company noted actually a great many things causing some slight instability on the margin front. First, on the positive side, they did note better inventory management. One thing in particular leadership mentioned last year they had to get better at. They also mentioned a reduction in shrink, which was a nice bonus for them, and also what they called material cost optimization. On the negative side, though, they noted commodity headwinds as well as the dreaded tariffs. And although many automotive parts are assembled domestically, some are made with foreign, or in this case, you know, Chinese parts that might be affected by those tariffs. Some are completely imported from China, not just assembled domestically, but assembled overseas as well. So that is something to keep in mind, not just for Advance, but everyone in this space. On the selling, general, and administrative expense front, they did note an 82 basis point increase as a percentage of net sales. This was driven by higher bonus costs and an increase in marketing spend, which was arguably needed, at least I would argue it was needed, to stem the potential continued loss of market share, which is something that we'll talk about here in a bit. However, they did manage to save somewhat SG&A through leveraging of labor and also reduced insurance and claims expense. So again, these numbers that we're talking about, they look good on first glance, but really the key here, especially as Layton mentioned with the big three, with O'Reilly, AutoZone, and Advance, how do these numbers from Advance stack up against others in the space? Well, fortunately for us, O'Reilly did release fourth quarter earnings on Wednesday of this week. And, you know, it's just important to stack one another up against each other to kind of evaluate. And we've talked about how O'Reilly and AutoZone have really been kind of running away with the market share. Well, the overall numbers, it's important to remember that Advance, after their assumption of Carquest and Carquest-related stores back in 2014, they've had the better of O'Reilly in terms of overall sales, but that may not be the case going forward. And Layton, I think it's important to also look at some of O'Reilly's numbers here from their earnings release on Wednesday.
Yeah, this marked the 26th consecutive year of full year-over-year comp sales growth for O'Reilly. That is just incredible. They displayed comp sales right in line with Advance, 3.3%. for their most recent quarter. And you really have to see that O'Reilly and Advance had similar comp sales increases, but that's really where the similarities end. Of course, O'Reilly saw overall sales increase for the fourth quarter by 6% year over year. This is a function of comps, but also new stores. This is the main differentiator, the main thing to write home about is, you know, between these two companies, Advance and others here, they are really opening a lot of stores. O'Reilly opened 190 new stores in the 2018 calendar year. Advance closed around 108. Like I said, they've been closing a lot of underperforming stores, really looking at the micro markets they do business in. I know in the Midwest, I live near a couple of Advance stores. They closed shop. Guess what? They were right next door to either an O'Reilly or an AutoZone. So it really tells you that maybe they're not afraid of competition, but they're going to be hypersensitive to it going forward. Moreover, O'Reilly projected 200 to 210 new store openings, net new store openings rather, for 2019 in their most recent call. AutoZone does not release earnings until next week, but in their latest fiscal quarter, they did show a same-store sales increase of 2.7%. So given the other two numbers that we have here around that 3.3% range, we would not be surprised to see AutoZone post that as well. While AutoZone has not quite been as bullish in opening new stores as O'Reilly, they still opened 153 net new stores in the last fiscal year there and have opened 91 new stores in the latest two quarters combined. So they have momentum as far as new development is concerned. And so while comp sales remain steady for Advance versus their competitors, they continue to lose market share as O'Reilly and AutoZone add more locations throughout the United States. And as these new locations see continued success, it's going to be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out. To wit, for the last comparable fiscal year, AutoZone sales were $11.2 billion and O'Reilly's were $9.54 billion for Advance. $9.6 billion, so still just a little bit ahead of O'Reilly, but trending in the wrong direction. And for the prior year, as an example, Advance came in at nearly $9.37 billion, O'Reilly at $8.98 billion, AutoZone, $10.89 billion. Advance clearly in the most stagnant area of the three. And O'Reilly's company projections for the next fiscal year, you ask? $10 billion to $10.3 billion compared to $9.65 to $9.8 billion. In other words, 2019 may be the first year O'Reilly passes Advance in sales since Advance's acquisition of GPII, which is, by the way, the owner of CarQuest and Worldpack, in January of 2014. Overall, Advance is in a better position today than they were a year ago at this time. That is a fact. But they are still in danger of losing ground to their two main competitors in 2019. If anything is a takeaway from the story, it is that competition is real for them. The big question, at least as far as we're concerned, when will they begin to meaningfully expand their store base once more? Because of all that consolidation, when are you going to reorganize, restructure, and now grow again? Ordinarily, we'd be all for making sure their current locations are optimized first, but now that their present stores appear to be headed in the right direction, they need to be constantly finding new areas for new development. If they don't, rest assured that O'Reilly and AutoZone will.
And expanding their total number of stores out there for Advance was not mentioned in their 2019 guidance that they gave on the call. They do expect rises in net sales to be roughly in line with their comp store sales increase of 1% to 2.5% they're expecting. And in fact, it's far from expanding. CEO Tom Greco mentioned on the call that they are still somewhat focused on closing certain locations throughout the chain. The idea here is that they are really concerned about cannibalism, not just within the brand, but as Leighton mentioned, where you have stores maybe next to an AutoZone or adjacent to an O'Reilly, and they're closing stores, ideally for Advance at least, where the customer base potentially can be transferred to another location. But honestly, for auto parts stores, this doesn't always work. Auto parts stores work a little bit differently than some other sections of retail. Customers see auto parts stores as a little bit more of a neighborhood store than a branded store. And all of three of these auto parts chains trying to get away from that with loyalty programs and the like, but still very tough to have someone drive an extra mile or 2 miles to an Advance when they've got an O'Reilly right across the street. So that's something to certainly keep in mind as Advance continues to kind of lose market share, even though, again, a more positive quarter than it was the fourth quarter of last year. Now, Advance stock fell slightly after the call to $163.05, falling even more in trading later in the week. In fact, as of recording, which is Thursday after market close, they're sitting at $161.31 per share. That's down from weekly highs of $172.32 per share that was achieved during trading on Tuesday immediately after the call. Coming up, we talk Samsung and we'll also talk retail real estate, one of our favorite topics. Now, Now on to the second half of the Retail Focus podcast as Samsung seeks to enter brick and mortar to a greater extent with the opening of 3 mall-based stores on Wednesday of this week. This as departure news of Apple's chief retail strategist surfaced over a week ago. Samsung is looking to compete directly with Microsoft and Apple stores in what we and others consider to be Class A malls. So you're not seeing these stores added to Class B or C malls anytime soon. Retail centers, as far as the Class A malls are concerned, that have been flourishing of late, and no doubt excited to get these Samsung stores in the mall portfolio, just as excited as Samsung is to enter the mall portfolio. And Leighton, these stores are going to carry the banner Samsung Experience. Sounds exotic.
Yeah, it certainly does. It sounds like a sexy name for Samsung, a company that we have never covered here on the podcast. A company we don't really think about in terms of brick and mortar retail either, because guess what? They don't have a presence in brick and mortar retail. They've only had one shop. It was really a concept shop, a flagship store, if you will, that was 55,000 square feet. I say is, it still exists to this day. They're calling for a larger digital playground presence throughout the United States, and executives are really thrilled about being able to have customers experience their products. And Samsung products span not just phones, but tablets, PCs, obviously TVs. They're known for their TVs. Their technology that goes into those 4K televisions are going to be really on display here. And before we dig into some of the details, that store in 2013, when that was built out, again, it was more of a flagship store, but it really wasn't an area where the company could display a lot of their products. It was more of a branding initiative. If you look at the pictures of that store to this day, it's just a lot of signage, a lot of exotic signage with the Samsung brand, a few phones here and there, a couple tablets, but more than anything, they're really touting their VR experience at this location. So it was in New York City in the Meatpacking District. It was something that caught a lot of attention, but something you and I, Trent, hadn't really talked about or felt a need to talk about on this podcast. It's just sort of a shop that didn't return a lot in terms of revenue. Again, it was more of just a brand driver. But now, you fast forward to 2019, Samsung is going to venture out with a new showroom that's going to feature all of those products I just mentioned, plus, again, that VR gear setup that they're so proud of. The 3 stores that they're going to be opening, they actually opened earlier this week on February 20th, the same day as their Samsung's Galaxy Unpacked 2019 event. That was a huge feature for the company, and this was something that caught a lot of attention. And what's interesting is that very little was highlighted from big media as far as these 3 stores getting rolled out in 3 new metropolitan areas for the company. Rather, it was the products that were displayed, because everybody loves the new Galaxy phones that they have. I personally have a Samsung Galaxy S9. I love it. But they created a new phone called the Samsung Fold that caught a lot of attention. 4.6-inch screen. It folds in half, but the phone's going to be fairly expensive at $2,000. All of that news totally covered up the fact that they are spending a lot of money in these development locations. These stores will have, like I said, phones, but 4K televisions, VR headsets for people to try on. It is meant to be like a Mac store, but on steroids, basically, and that a lot of these customers are going to get more of a hands-on experience with the product. And you have to scratch your head and say, well, Apple stores do a fairly good job of displaying their products, having enough displays open for customers to try, even at the peak times of the day on the weekend. But looking at the pictures of these stores, they have a U-shaped, what they call a U-shaped bar in the very center, tons of phones on display. And to be honest with you, something that the Apple stores have been lacking, and perhaps this is one of the reasons that we've seen some change over there in terms of retail leadership, is the fact that while the stores are beautiful and open and you have glass front doors, it really is much of the same in terms of what they've been doing over the last 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. It's the same run-of-the-mill type of branding from Apple. Yes, it's clean. Yes, it's clear. Yes, they have plenty of customer service. But there is just something, almost an intangible quality that you can get from these pictures of these new stores. By the way, they're going to be located one in the LA area, in the Glendale area, Houston at the Galleria, which is a huge shopping district. A lot of our listeners may have not been there, but Houston is known for their shopping. Despite what you may think from the outside, they have huge shopping centers. The Galleria is going to host this first Samsung store. The other Samsung Experience store is going to be in Long Island, New York, right along Americana Way in Roosevelt Field, in that mall there. And I think this is going to be a good first entrance for these Samsung Experience stores, because you do want to make an impression. You want to make an impression on not just your core customer, because everyone knows the Samsung brand when it comes to phones, but not everybody knows the Samsung brand when it comes to retail. Like you mentioned Apple, over 500 stores globally. Well, everybody pretty much knows that when you go to an A-class mall, there's probably going to be an Apple shop and it's probably going to be big and nice, but not a lot of people think of retail when they think Samsung. And if you want to make an impression on the people that actually care within this sector, you have to go big or go home. And I think that's exactly what they've done here. And I think that's exactly what they need to do, and maybe jumping ahead a little bit here, but if they want to build out new locations in new areas of the country, stay with the same theme. Go to nice areas such as the Galleria, so A-class malls, either indoor or outdoor, but in popular shopping districts in very densely populated areas. And I think you're going to make a very positive impression on a number of individuals who want to familiarize themselves with these new devices and these new features. Because like I said, I love Samsung. Personally, I have a Samsung TV, I have a Samsung phone. That's pretty much it for Samsung for me, but I know nothing about their VR experience and what assets they have that other companies don't. This is a great time or a great opportunity for them to show customers like me, who are pretty much passive customers, excited about the brand, but maybe not excited about all of the different innovations they have going on behind the scenes. This is a great opportunity to tell me as an individual who already owns Samsung products, why I should keep buying different products from the company. And I think this is a good time to do so. And by the way, Trent, that one new store in LA, it's going to be right across from an Apple store. So it's really sort of going head to head. People are saying, oh, that's sort of a foray into a retail war between these two companies. But listen, three stores versus over 500, that's sort of a drop in the bucket for Samsung. But overall, I think it's a good entrance into this retail marketplace. And I think I am personally excited about it, since I now live in the Southern California area. I will be visiting that store that has been open for around 2 days now.
And for our final story, we go back to one of our favorite REITs, as the Retail Opportunity Investments Corporation released earnings after the bell on Tuesday. Now, longtime listeners, or at least medium longtime listeners that have been listening to the podcast, I guess, for 3 months or longer, will recall our bullishness following their last earnings call in November, as they posted very strong metrics in about every possible category for a retail REIT, including far above average occupancy rates. And it was more of the same for their latest fourth quarter report, as earnings per share and revenue both beat estimates. Now, a quick refresher, Retail Opportunity Investments Corporation, or ROIC, usually traffics in grocery-anchored shopping centers along the West Coast. Now, ROIC reported quarter four earnings per share of 9 cents per share. That's a cent better than the analyst estimate of 8 cents. Revenue for the quarter came in at $75.16 million versus the consensus estimate of $74.59 million. So slight analyst beats, but again, that's not really why we're talking about them on the show here. So again, we're looking at West Coast retailer, largely West Coast retail, and you know, ROIC deals heavily in a lot of different retail areas along the West Coast, meaning that they are a little bit of a bellwether for how West Coast retail, and more importantly, how West Coast retail real estate is shaping up as we hit 2019. Now, at year's end, they hit a record high for the company of 97.7% occupancy, leasing a total of 1.5 million square feet. The company finished the year off with 97 shopping centers and having signed 406 leases 250 of which were renewed leases. This, by the way, their fifth straight year of 97% occupancy or better, so far outpacing the national average. Part of this is, of course, the area of the country. As we've mentioned before, there's a lot of markets on the West Coast where, honestly, retail real estate is tough to come by because occupancy rates are so high. And we should note now that active acquisitions and divestments have contributed to this figure, as they've disposed of properties or sold off properties that no longer fit in their criteria of what they want to hold in their portfolio. And some of these properties may have been a little bit more towards the distressed side of the spectrum, although we would not consider them distressed properties at all. And that said, most of what they've sold has been done with a value add strategy in mind, where they've actually increased value based on higher occupancy or increased lease rates or re-upped leases. Essentially, even though these properties no longer fit in their ideal portfolio, they were still able to improve them from where they were when they were purchased originally. They specifically actually on the call noted a property sold for $28 million and another for $17 million during the 2018 calendar year. And leadership said they have two more properties that they anticipate selling over the next 6 months, longer closing periods on those, kind of drawing the process out. Also, in regards to the improvement aspect of the properties to be disposed of, they said they're actually completing leasing objectives on a handful of other properties so as to prepare them for sale, get them ready to put on the market. And Layton, one of the key things to note about this earnings call, same center NOI growth was also achieved, giving the company momentum into the 2019 calendar year. Now, this is something that we revisit and revisit as pertains to retail real estate, but can you give a quick refresher for our listeners as to what we mean by that NOI growth?
NOI is such a common term in the real estate industry, either with single family homes or the commercial property space, which obviously includes retail, but NOI simply stands for net operating income. It is the income that any given asset or any one asset produces. So after taxes, insurance, and things like maintenance costs, anything that comes up in terms of operating that asset to its fullest potential, everything that's left over after all of the rents are paid for a given year, that's your net operating income. And this is a figure that, again, is looked at very commonly, especially in terms of rate of returns. If you're looking to buy a property, let's say there's a property that's been on the market for a little while, it's representing a cap rate, something they call a cap rate of around 8%. You're basically dividing the net operating income of that asset by the purchase price. And so a lot of people look at that figure as sort of a return on investment, at least for the short to midterm. And you can use it as a means of valuation as well. So a lot of appraisers out there for commercial property, especially retail property, a lot of the research is done looking based on lease comp. So if a particular property has leases that are in line with a lot of other properties in the area, they can simply multiply that out by the number of square footage the property has and get you a pretty good consistent valuation. Again, given on a number of different variables as well, as far as area and where that property sits. But other streaks include four consecutive years for the company of same space cash rent growth on new leases in excess of 20%. This company, Trent, is doing very well operationally, not just the NOI, but in fact, among the renewed leases, 250 in all, during the year, they had a 9.1% average rent increase. So those tenants that are staying in the properties, they're paying more in rent. And guess what? That NOI is going to increase as a result of that. But overall, in the fourth quarter alone, the ink dried on 109 leases, including 40 new leases for the company, covering 118,000 square feet. These 40 new leases managed a whopping 26.8% increase in same space cash rent. So again, this is interesting because it's not just those current tenants that are renegotiating leases and getting a lease extension to stay at a property longer. These are spaces that were left vacant for, let's say, a period of time. New tenants have come in and they're able to leverage a massive rent increase versus the previous tenant that was in there. And this relates to a lot of what we talk about on the podcast, because everyone talks about retail is dying. Anytime a retail files for bankruptcy or consolidates their store base. And this comes up a lot, and this has come up twice in the last 6 months when we've talked about Sears on this podcast, and that there was a lot of skepticism as to whether or not landlords could actually have an increase in same space cash rents when Sears leaves. A lot of people saying that it may not happen if you aren't able to really develop into mixed-use spaces, these old Sears locations or Kmart locations, but it's actually been proving to be the opposite. Some of these spaces are staying, you know, not too redeveloped, and you can get a Ross in there, you can get a TJ Maxx in there, maybe build out a couple retaining malls, and guess what? You're seeing double-digit increases in same-space rents. Same thing here, but with a lot less work involved. Stuart A. Tanz, president and CEO of the Retail Opportunity Investments Corporation, stated that during 2018, and I quote here, "We again achieved strong, record-setting results with property operations." One of their more interesting initiatives here we want to highlight is really keep an eye on for 2019 is their desire to fold residential developments into their existing commercial properties. And this is something we've seen a lot with newer developments in suburban areas. One of their more interesting initiatives here, Tan said on the call, is to have additional housing in the area surrounding certain shopping centers in their portfolio. And they hope to take advantage of that through what they call densification. In other words, they hope to use the land or properties to create multifamily housing. This was foreshadowed by PRSA's annual report on real estate trends, predicting more developers and REITs would eventually go this route into really seeing the entire site for what it is. People want to work and play and shop all in the same area. And this is really true of a lot of millennials, especially the younger millennials that are out there trying to move out for the first time. They want to be not only near work, but they want to be able to be close to a bar, be close to a shopping center, be close to anything that a commercial retail property would have to offer. And so the one concern we would have is that multifamily does carry with it completely different set of responsibilities for the property owner, but that's a topic for another podcast. We all know that managing different types of properties, totally different dynamic. Even though it all falls under the umbrella of commercial real estate, it is different in terms of day-to-day management. And part of their plan, by the way, is to contribute land as their equity in a 50-50 joint venture with other developers. And this is common with multifamily housing, but when it's all said and done, they hope to gain in return in the mid 7% range, which is pretty good because with cap rates so low right now, that return is certainly above average, especially in some of the coastal markets where you can see 4 and 5% cap rates as sort of the new norm. And one such densification project we should note is at the Crossroads Shopping Center in the Seattle area. And I know, Trent, you and I have both visited there here in the last few years. They're in the process there of adding 185 senior housing units to the premises. So really trying to reach out there, really trying to diversify, if you will, all of their investments going forward. And in order to add residential opportunities and develop other parcels, they put an emphasis on removing restrictions on new or renewed anchor leases. And oftentimes, tenants will have restrictions on co-tenants, but also the ability to develop out parcels based on sight lines and parking restrictions. This is basically a way to unlock value in shopping centers previously capped out with certain leases, and with 97.7% occupancy right now within the company, they certainly have a lot of these.
Overall, this earnings call underscored a couple of different trends in West Coast retail. One, rents going up for retailers, especially as new leases are signed, and two, the continued mix of residential and retail together in various developments. Now, regarding the rising rent rates, as we've said before, and as Leighton just mentioned, this is really going to handcuff struggling retailers looking to potentially renegotiate leases to attempt to stay afloat, particularly on the coast. We just talked a couple of weeks ago about Tuesday Morning, hoping that they can perhaps renegotiate some of their leases. Well, look, in a lot of areas, a lot of, in particular, A-class shopping centers, those landlords aren't going to be as amenable to it, because you look at an occupancy rate of 97.7%, it's pretty likely that a company like ROIC is going to be able to find another tenant to fill into that space. And that's actually something they mentioned during the earnings call is every time an anchor shuffles out, they're able to actually fill that space with an anchor that's just paying more per square foot. And they talk about getting rid of a couple of anchors who are paying below market rents over the last year. And by getting rid of, I mean, the lease expired. That anchor didn't want to come back. So they said, hey, you know what? That's fine. We've got a waiting list of people waiting to get into that space. And I understand that's not going to be the case with every bit of retail real estate in the U.S. But, you know, there are articles in a lot of different places, including there was an article recently on USA Today about how, you know, there's a lot of retail real estate vacancies in the U.S. But when you look at the numbers and when you look at the lease rate increases, those stats just don't bear out the idea that we're seeing this massive amount of retail vacancies in the United States. Are some areas pretty hard hit? Yeah, absolutely. But there are these markets like the West Coast and most of the East Coast, as well as a lot of Texas, that are seeing these occupancy rates really, really high up. And I think that's going to ultimately keep the real estate game strong as it pertains to retail going forward. And you're not going to see as many of those lease renegotiations as some of those struggling companies felt like you were going to see a couple of years ago.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I choose a story that we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. And I closed out that last section speaking of struggling retailers, and let's keep it going here, as a report came out via USA Today this week that Charlotte Russe may begin to shut down its stores and operations in early March if a winning bid doesn't emerge to bring the retailer out of bankruptcy. Now, Charlotte Russe applied for bankruptcy, and it said that it would likely close 94 of more than its 500 stores. Well, if they cannot find an appropriate buyer, Charlotte Russe said in a statement that, again, they may have to wind down all of its store locations and operations beginning on or about March 7th, 2019. And I quote that directly from the Charlotte Russe release. Now, this is problematic because not only do you have a lot of employees there, but also, you know, Charlotte Russe is in a lot of not only A-class malls, but also B and C-class malls as well. Those malls might be struggling a little bit more than those A-class malls to find tenants. And the company overall employs, according to USA Today, more than 8,700 workers. So it's obviously a bad thing for the workers. But ultimately, again, the question has to be asked, are there just too many players in this particular space? 10 to 15 years ago, Charlotte Russe had a differentiable product. Right now, their product is a little bit bland compared to a lot of other mall retailers that are out there. And I think that's one of the things that overall you've seen in the last 2-3 years. You've seen all of this doom and gloom surrounding these retail bankruptcies. But in reality, I think Charlotte Russe is a victim of something else, which is just simply a saturated market when it comes to fashion in the mall space. And you know, ultimately, Charlotte Russe still faces a problem if they do find a buyer. How do you get back to profitability? But not so much profitability. How do you get back to having a product that differentiates you from the likes of Forever 21 and the other mall staples that are out there? So very interesting to see going forward, especially in a market where you're seeing a lot of other, you know, if not closures, tapering backs. Leighton mentioned H&M in a Looking Ahead segment a few weeks back. So ultimately, Charlotte Russe may be another victim of this. But again, I think it's more symptomatic of maybe just cutting down on what was a saturated mall market versus something that's a more general retail malaise.
Well, now that you've brought me down a little bit from that depressing retail story, even though this was supposed to be a positive podcast, I will try to switch gears and make it positive once again, as CVS had reported earnings on Wednesday of this week. The stock actually reset a little bit. It ended up finishing 8% down on the news of their earnings report. As far as the earnings per share side of things, they ended up coming in a little bit above expectations. Revenue was actually down a little bit versus analyst expectations. But the big story, the big headline for me and all of the other retail gurus out there was the fact that they indicated that the integration cost for the Aetna merger may be a little bit more than was first thought, thus wiping away a lot of those synergistic savings that everybody touted at the beginning of this partnership. A lot of analysts now, a lot of people from the outside, big banks, are saying that potentially this was more of a defensive move than an integration and a strategy to move the business forward into this larger entity for the future that is really supposed to consolidate certain processes and streamline all of the benefit manager business that they have with their customer base. And I think it's an interesting business that we have talked about at length about here and there as far as the Aetna merger is concerned, or as far as them in the pharmacy benefit manager services division. I think CVS is a highly complex business, but from the retail side, it's fairly streamlined. And we think that they have a good brand ever since they rebranded to CVS Health and stopped carrying tobacco products and bringing in a little bit more customers through that way of advertising their retail business. I think it's going to be a business for the long haul. And so again, I certainly am not one to forecast certain stocks. I have no position in CVS, but I think right now or over the next 6 months, let's say, if there is a larger reset on the company, would maybe, if you again like to partake in the stock market investing world, this would be a good time to maybe look at CVS as a stock to maybe take a position in. Because overall, Trent, I think this is going to be a company, both CVS and Walgreens, I might add, it's going to be a company that's going to be around 10, 20, 30 years. And if we look at retailers that are recession-proof, retailers that are Amazon-proof, I think CVS definitely fits into that space because they're extremely smart as to where they go for new locations. They're extremely smart as to where they invest, and they're extremely smart into the day-to-day operations on the retail side of things, an area that has seen softness for Walgreens. And while CVS still has a ways to go for the front-end sales, I think overall the business is fundamentally sound. And I think it sort of really draws home the fact that if you look at their expected range for revenues in this coming year, this coming fiscal year, actually ended up topping those analyst forecasts for that top line revenue. They're looking to bring in between $249 billion and $254 billion. The pharmacy market, the retail pharmacy market, has exploded. And while there are disruptors like Amazon who want to get in on the action, it just really hasn't stuck. And I think it's interesting because we talk about price elasticity a lot on this podcast. If a price of something goes up, how much more willing is the individual buying that product to go maybe to something else that is lesser priced? But I think with pharmacy products, all in all, pricing is pretty much streamlined among all of the big pharmacy players. You think Walmart, Kroger, Walgreens, CVS, Rite Aid, right? But overall, I think once somebody gets hooked to a brand, they like the level of service with a retail pharmacy, they tend to stick with them. And a lot of people love and stick with CVS, especially those Target customers, ever since they had to switch over from that acquisition. So I think overall, that acquisition of that particular business and the fact that, yes, the forecast for earnings per share is going to be a little bit down below where analysts had pegged them for this forthcoming year, I think everything that they've done, and CEO Larry Merlo in particular, have done for the company, all of that integration is for the common good and to draw more customers into their overall business. I think it's going to be a large health care pipeline, if you will, for the future. Again, we're looking in a long time span here. 10, 20 years, I believe CVS is going to stick around, and now may be the time to take advantage of the downturn in their stock price.
That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Once again, for Layton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. Again, check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, and we'll be back 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.